G'day and welcome. I'm Cassie McCullough and this is The List, RN's weekly peek into the distractingly sexy world of popular culture and TV. Although for Game of Thrones fans, it's been more of a distressingly inconclusive week as season 5 ended with a WTF moment of epic proportions. I'm sure I wasn't the only one Googling the bastards of the Targaryen bloodline and the prophecy of the three dragon riders. Anyway, that's a matter for another day. Today, we're concerned with real-world matters. A bit later, we'll take a look at the sartorial semiotics of the US presidential race, and we're turning our minds to the past and the future. As you know, all this week on RN, we've been marking 800 years since Magna Carta was sealed. Well, today we're going to look at the idea of a digital Magna Carta, which was first discussed last year by the British computer scientist Tim Berners-Lee, the man credited with inventing the World Wide Web 25 years ago.
I wanted to use this 25th anniversary to think about what sort of a web we want. There are lots of sites where people have started to put together a Magna Carta, a Bill of Rights for the web. How about we do that? How about we decide these are, in a way, becoming fundamental rights, the right to communicate with whom I want. What would be on your list for that Magna Carta? Let's crowdsource a Magna Carta for the web. Let's do that this year. Let's use the energy from the 25th anniversary to crowdsource a Magna Carta for the web.
Well, a call to arms of sorts, but what's happened in the 12 months since then, and was it ever realistic? To look at this, we have two of the finest minds of the digital generation, Mark Pesce, futurist and honorary fellow of the University of Sydney's Digital Cultures Department. G'day, Mark. You were there at the very beginning of the web.
Yes.
Yes.
I was there.
Also with us, we have Chris Despain. He is the chief executive of AUDA, ALDA. It's the Australian Domain Name Administrator. G'day, Chris.
Good afternoon.
Now, just quickly for people who haven't heard of ALDA, you're a non-government, not-for-profit organisation.
Yes.
That is licensed.
Right, endorsed by the federal government to run.au, which is the Australian country code.
Right. So you set up domain names.
All of the web addresses that are run in Australia with .au at the back of them or front of them, depending on which way you look at it, are licensed through us effectively.
And all around the world, they're similar organisations. Yes. And you're about to race off to Buenos Aires to go to an international meeting. Yes. Of similar organisations.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So we hear Tim Berners-Lee there asking for the crowd to come up with an idea for a Magna Carta. Mark Pesce, is the crowd just exhausted?
Well, the crowd is actually doing an awful lot, but the crowd is also very big. There are now, 3 billion regular users of the web. And so if the call goes out to just a small percentage of them who are sufficiently activated to be able to really get into this, that's still an enormous number of hands and minds at this work. And there are clearly enough people who are concerned about the legal status of people on the internet and on the web to have a good crack at that.
Do you think, Chris Despain, that the crowd is the right set of people to come up with some idea like this?
Yeah. Well, it depends, doesn't it? I mean, the problem with things like this is that the requirement of stuff like this is you start with activists. That's what happens. It's just the way these things are. And then after that, if it gets picked up by the more, perhaps less activist and more moderate, it then gets shaped into something that might be workable.
And you can go back, 1996, John Perry Barlow produces something called the Declaration of Independence for Cyberspace. It got printed in Wired magazine, got transferred around. Pretty much everyone who was online got to see it at one point.
And that's about four people.
Yeah, well, 1996.
This is this sort of wacky, far out sci-fi. Look, I've got the first bit here. Let me just read you how it goes. Governments of the industrial world, you weary giants of flesh and steel, I come from cyberspace, the new home of mind. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. You are not welcome among us. You have no sovereignty where we gather. Wow, kind of awesome.
And also, and I think crazy. Very much because John Perry Barlow, again, lyricist for the Grateful Dead. So there's all of that sort of San Francisco psychedelia, but also then Western Ranger. So there's this libertarian streak, and everything sort of piles into this one document. It's not long. People can Google it right now and they'll read it. It's, you know, I don't know, 500-600 words. And it lays out a vision for this new space government, keep your hands off of it, which, of course, was almost a calling card for exactly the opposite.
Government immediately let in and went, right, we better have that.
Yes.
So, actually, hello, over here.
But actually, in truth, if you look at it, really, if you think about that, so when was that? That was 96. That's like 20 years ago, very nearly. I mean, actually, pretty much, it is kind of, in many countries at least, it is government hands off and has been for 20 years.
So someone did answer Tim Berners-Lee call, and that was the British Library. Over the last year, they've had an exhibition about Magna Carta, and part of it was looking at the idea of how you'd go about a digital version. They asked 3,000 people under the age of 18, which is a very interesting crowd to source, what they thought should be the rules, more or less, of the web. Just this week, they've released the results, and here's the top favourites. The web we want will not let companies pay to control it and not let governments restrict our right to information, allow freedom of speech, be free from government censors in all countries, be available for those who wish to use it, be free from mass surveillance, allow equal access to knowledge, information and current news worldwide, and not sell our personal information and preferences for money, and make it clearer if the company or website intends to do so. You can see more of that online at the British Library. Very interesting to choose under 18s for that task.
When you launch something like this, if you're serious about it, you actually want naivety, don't you? I mean, the problem with asking us grown-ups about it is that we come with our own baggage and agendas immediately, and usually a horse we've been riding for quite some considerable time. So naivety is good, I think.
And yet, in some ways, what we've seen over the last 20 years is that people do vote on the web with their attention, with their eyeballs,
absolutely,
with their dollars. And so, in some ways, the kids are almost asking the governments to conform with the world that they're already in every time they use their mobile or every time they just, you know, open up a laptop.
Exactly.
Okay, let's tackle it. Is it actually possible to create a Magna Carta?
Well, it's very romantic, isn't it, really? If you call it a Magna Carta, it sounds incredibly romantic and it's something we should all do and it's wonderful and blah.
Well, except that this is a document that stops a civil war, right? We sort of have to go back to this idea that Magna Carta was forged as a document that stopped a civil war, and the only reason the king signed it is because if he didn't, they were probably going to cut off his head. Mm. And so there's that sense there that unless we get to that point, that kind of pressure point, do you actually get people literally on the same page about what's important?
We can't agree about human rights.
It's extremely hard, isn't it?
It's very hard.
And the problem, I started off by saying it's a romantic idea because I think it is, and we are talking effectively about a Bill of Rights for the internet. The challenge, from my point of view, is I think it's a fantastic goal to have. The danger, the downside perhaps, is that the moment you have that is you then need something to enforce it. Mm. And the moment you need something to enforce it, then you're talking about some kind of cross-jurisdictional, nation-free thing. That makes it worse.
You're talking about the thing that we've seen emerge, which is this kind of mob rule.
Yeah.
Right? And you kind of go, neither of these are particularly good. You don't really want to have that kind of untrammeled power, and yet this is the world we live in. And so if you're talking about limits to executive power, those limits have to apply in both directions, right? They have to apply not just to the state and anyone who'd be using that, but they have to apply to the people who are actually comprising the mob.
So the basic challenge of freedom of speech, if you give people freedom of speech, they will use it and you have to live with the consequences.
And they're going to upset other people in that use.
There's a fallacy that we're at heart good people. And it's a fallacy because we're not. We're at heart a mob. Give us a chance and we will become a mob.
We are children with better manners.
Correct. And we will go and in the physical world, we will go and stand outside the prison while this guy who's been charged with, hasn't been found guilty of anything yet, when we'll beat on the side of the police van and we'll scream obscenities, which, and 200 years ago, we went and attended you know, public executions. Tyburn, yeah. Exactly. So you know, it's a fallacy to suggest that allowing us to yeah. we are not that good.
But John Ronson, the writer, wrote a book recently called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and he traced...
Was it a list of people who'd been publicly
well,
shamed?
Well, pretty much. He traced some dreadful case histories of people like Janine Sacco, who made that ill-thought-out tweet about not getting AIDS in Africa because she was white, which was an ironic statement about race. By the time she got off the plane in Africa, you know, all these consequences had happened. She'd lost her job. People from her high school were contacting her saying, I'm so sorry to see what's happening to you. Mm. And her life's effectively been destroyed.
Yep.
He says this is new. This isn't the old village square kind of shaming. This is... something that's been unleashed by the environment of anonymity. And so it does need to be addressed somehow. Mark, I see you frowning.
Well, I mean, the power of the mob is the power of anonymity as well. And so I think the scale issue is completely new, right? You could not get a million people from all around the world mobilized around something, which is what happened to Ms. Sacco. So that part is absolutely new. But I think that the blind fury of taking someone and pillorying them, that's pretty old. And so we're kind of dealing with the fact that we've got this very new weapon for this very old tendency inside of us. We now have, I think last week we saw a whole bunch of comedians screaming that, you know, the age of real comedy is over because people take offense too easily. And if there is essentially no phrase that anyone can utter with any degree of humor or irony or satire that is not going to absolutely upset someone else. And so we're now in this weird case where are we simply going to be absolutely vanilla because that's the kind of thing that allows us to all get along, or are we all going to be outraged all the time, or is there a middle ground?
Well, you know, I think there is a chilling effect of that, and I'm sure people were much more freewheeling and wild before every part of their lives was potentially recorded.
Do you think, really?
But this is also, then this comes back to that idea of the Magna Carta, which is freedom from surveillance, is this thing that shows up on the British Library list. Exactly. It's an issue that we're having a very active debate about in Australia right now when you talk about metadata collection. And so where does that sit for people? How do we actually frame the fact that we're being watched? Not even necessarily by George Brandis, but by everyone in the country.
It's fascinating. And I agree with you. It's fascinating. One of the things that I see a lot of is that, and this is not meant to be having a go at civil society, but people who wear the civil society banner and stand at microphones and talk about privacy, on the one hand, they're very vehement about privacy and they want that. But on the other hand, they're also equally vehement about sort of freedom of speech. And the two things are not necessarily compatible all of the time. Right. You know, we have people in the domain name game, in the web address game, saying I should be able to register a web address without having to tell anybody who I am at all. I should just be able to register it. And you say, well, okay, but what happens if you use that for a nefarious... Well, I wouldn't. But what happens if somebody does? Well, then we should find out who they are.
And this, so well, real, maybe that's a valid
approach.
It's a
real challenge, right?
I mean, basic criminal law might apply there.
Yes, well, yeah.
But this is also the issue around it being a public good, right? The thing is, a domain name is actually, in some sense, a limited resource. And so you actually have to have some sense of how it's not just mine to use any way that I can. And I guess maybe that's something around public discourse. You know, you should have a right to free speech, but do you have a right to hate speech? And this is always that.
But what is that? Then it becomes a real issue, doesn't it? Well, what is hate speech?
Well, you can tell when there's a mob with pitchforks and torches, right?
That's true.
Not necessarily.
No,
that's hate action, not hate speech. But yes.
Yes. Well, this comes right down to the notion of governance, which is what your organisation is part of trying to do, Chris. I guess the Magna Carta has been invested with so much meaning, and what we've been learning over the last week is really it was a vibe thing. In fact, it doesn't ensure rights as we imagine it would. It's just something, an idea that people grasped onto, and perhaps that's what Tim Berners-Lee is calling for in his call for a digital Magna Carta.
But if it's a vibe thing, then it's actually still it's an ideal. And you can always measure yourself against that ideal. How are we doing in Australia against that ideal of rights? So in that sense, for Tim wants us to think about this because we need to embed that ideal in our thinking so that when we rock up to something, we can go, how does this make me feel in terms of what I think we should have?
You think that has value, as it, the ideal has value even if it's unenforceable?
Well, I mean, you're also talking about a generation, that generation of kids who came up with that list, they're the next generation of coders. So when they're building these systems, they will then embody these ideals in the systems they design.
Completely agree. And I think it is worth having as an ideal. The only caveat I would place on it is I think we need to get very clear about the cost of that. So I don't mean physical, I don't mean financial, I just mean the cost.
So getting the countries like China, Russia,
Iran,
Denmark.
Yeah.
To sign up to these kind of, well, Denmark isn't it the home of pirates?
Yes.
To sign up to this would be almost impossible. Is there a way through?
Well, the Chinese will sign up to it. They'll just ignore it. They'll claim that they're a part of the system.
And Magna Carta with Chinese characteristics.
Exactly. Human rights. We believe, you know, we believe in human rights our way.
But is there a corporate way of doing this? I mean,
corporate. Did you say?
Yes. Like, is there a way in the free market to perhaps? I don't know. I'm no economist, but maybe taxing all credit card transactions or there being some kind of financial penalty that the world's banks sign up to. I mean, is that a possibility?
For what, though?
So already when you breach that charter, you're probably going to lose some customers and you give your – again, this is the battle that Google and Apple are fighting right now. They're kind of not articulating the exact rights of the Magna Carta, but Apple is saying that Google is making its money by selling your privacy, by basically violating that Magna Carta. And so whether or not they're dancing around the point exactly, these are now starting to become economic ideas. So really it's already happening.
Yeah, and I'm not quite sure when we woke up believing that we could have completely free access to email and completely free access to a huge search engine that would give us accurate data on anything we wanted to look up.
I think Google told us that. That was the thing. We just never asked what the price was.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, clearly there's always going to be a price.
Okay, Mark, you're a futurist. Mm. Is anything that we come up with in 2015 going to be of any value in even 10 years, let alone another 800?
There's no question that the way we think about our persons and the way we want to preserve our identity as persons is going to remain relevant. That said, there are more voices in our head than there ever have been, and we are struggling to frame those. 2020, so that's 60 months from now, 80% of all adults on the planet are carrying a smartphone around with them. So it doesn't matter where you are. You are now connected to Facebook, you're connected to Twitter, you're connected to Baidu or whatever it might be. And so every one of us is going to be in each other's faces, and we're really not good at it right now. And so part of what we get to learn over the next 20 years is how to tolerate all of this difference.
Christy Spain, is there any chance that making regulation happen now is actually going to limit the growth of this new era we find ourselves in?
If you made regulation happen now, then the answer is it probably would. It would certainly stifle innovation. The real question is, can you? And you can't. I just don't think you can. I mean, it's so cross-jurisdictional. It's so complicated to try and make the stuff that would work across the web. I mean, I can't see how you could do it. Look, politicians can get cheap wins by saying, we're going to do this or we're going to do that. But it really makes no difference. I mean, if you look at, this is a very simple example. If you look at the difference between the US and Australia, Australia dealt with online gambling by not allowing Australian companies to operate online gambling. So we have a vibrant online gambling industry in Australia, but all the money's going overseas. The Americans, on the other hand, just went, no credit card transactions for online gambling, end of story. Now, that's fine. And you can
do that. That's the corporate regulation I was looking for.
Exactly. Now, you can do that in your own jurisdiction. What you cannot do is stop people from going outside of your jurisdiction. And it's almost impossible to regulate, with one exception, which is give it all to the United Nations, which would mean that you could regulate it, but it would be an abject failure.
Well, who's to say that would be a certainty, but yeah.
Well, let's try and think of an example of where it's been a success then, shall we? You know, good luck with that.
All right, well then, what do you see down the track that's likely? And who will lead it?
Education, and the next generation will lead it. Mm. Education, the ones who grow up with this in their pocket will finally figure it out that actually it is, the power is enormous and the dangers are enormous, and it's all about, you know, us looking at self-regulating and educating. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I'm hoping that we aren't consigned to the dustbin of history too quickly.
You know, true.
We've actually lived through the transition. They've always been on one side of it.
Yes.
And so part of what we can, I think, bring to the discussion is, well, this is how things used to work before. Before we were all connected, we had these kinds of guidelines to civil discourse. And so I don't think we actually want to junk any of that.
No, I agree
because
with
we
that.
Actually learned a lot as a culture. And up to including Magna Carta, that we don't really have to start from zero. We can rethink and we can update. And so I think part of what we have to do is inject our own capacity for history and memory into that.
Thank you both for musing this question with us.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Chris Dispain is the Chief Executive Officer of AUDA, the Australian Domain Name Administrator, and Mark Pesci is a futurist and an honorary fellow at the University of Sydney's Digital Cultures Department. On RN, I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is The List. Now, when Hillary Clinton stepped onto a stage on Roosevelt Island last weekend to kick off her presidential campaign, she was wearing a cerulean blue silk Ralph Lauren pantsuit. It was a move that was as considered and as calculated as any of the words she spoke. Her sartorial semiotics have been analysed by the Washington Post, the New York Times, amongst others. To decode some of the meaning of this outfit, we're turning to Dr. Nadia Buick, fashion curator, writer, and our regular correspondent. G'day, Nadia.
Hi, Cassie.
Now, of course, the pantsuit has always been Hillary's signature item. What was so important about this particular one?
Well, I think it speaks to the fact that, you know, of course, she was under particular scrutiny at this moment because it was the opening of her campaign rally. So all eyes were really on her. And of course, in politics, in the public arena, what people wear, particularly what women wear, is read and digested very seriously. And even though we know that Hillary, as you say, often wears pantsuits, it's kind of her uniform. I think this one in particular was analysed because of her choice of colour, her choice of designer, and as a way to test what kind of image she's going to be cultivating this time around in her presidential campaign.
Okay, well, let's start with the fact that it was Ralph Lauren. What's the meaning of a Ralph Lauren outfit in this context?
Ralph Lauren is a very successful American fashion designer, so you've got a tick there. He's an American. Hillary Clinton in the past has worn a lot of American designers. She famously wore a lot of clothes by the late Oscar de la Renta, who was a Dominican American. And so I think that the choice to go with Ralph Lauren is a continuation of her supporting local designers. Ralph Lauren himself is an interesting choice because in a way he both embodies the American dream. He was the son of Jewish immigrants. He grew up in the Bronx in a poor neighborhood and has become an incredibly successful designer and really a symbol of upper middle class affluence in the United States.
So Ralph Lauren's style is this sort of signature Americana, but of a higher echelon. It's a sort of upmarket American style, very nostalgic, but also very patriotic. And I guess it's no coincidence that not so long ago he spent $13 million of his own money preserving one of the oldest versions of the American flag.
Yeah, and the flag is a really important motif in his clothing. It's something that he reworks all the time. He uses the colours from the flag. He uses stars and stripes a lot in his clothes. And I think, you know, really what he's doing is he's drawing on a narrative, as you say, a nostalgic narrative about the States. And he inflects all of his clothing with it. And on the one hand, it's quite accessible. It's sportswear inflected clothing. But on the other hand, it does also have this kind of quite refined, slightly upper class, I suppose, aspirational quality to it.
Also the colour. Now, this cerulean, I'm calling it, but it was a very sort of royal blue. The very first Instagram picture that Hillary ever put up was of a set of her pantsuits, and they were red, white and blue. Is this a kind of nod to the flag as well?
Absolutely. I think it is definitely a nod to the flag. It's a nod to the fact that she knows that she's going to be scrutinised for her fashion choices. She's kind of getting out there ahead of everyone else. And it's fascinating that for her first ever post on Instagram, she's gone with a post about how she looks, about her clothing. And of course, she called the caption for the photo was Hard Choices, which is the name of her book. But it's also about her poking fun at herself. The fact that, of course, she knows that the choice that she makes is going to be scrutinised, but she's not taking it too seriously. It's a very knowing post.
Because this has been an ongoing joke with Hillary, the pantsuit. She's been much kind of ridiculed for this choice that she's made. And in the last presidential campaign where she ran but was, as history shows, obviously knocked out by Barack Obama, this was an ongoing narrative. Here's just a few moments from back then.
Well, look, you know, in my White House, we will know who wears the pantsuits.
Hell yeah!
Thanks to the internet, I can order new pantsuits 24/7.
There you go.
There's your pantsuit.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Senator. Thank you so very much.
I guess my favorite message was from a woman named Angela. Keep strong, she said. It's not over until the lady in the pantsuit says it is.
So we have a variety of different moments there, but a lot of them with David Letterman, who made this one of his signature things, sending up Hillary for her pantsuit. Why did she choose the pantsuit? How did it become her signature?
Well, it's something that she has worn for quite a long time. She was actually the first and only First Lady to wear a pantsuit in the official first portrait of her as First Lady when Bill Clinton was president. So it's not exactly new, but I think it's become more and more a staple. If you look back at images of her when she was the First Lady of the United States, she was wearing the pantsuit, but she was also wearing skirt suits. She was wearing dresses. There was a lot more pattern in her wardrobe. And then as she has progressed in her political career through to being Secretary of State and now running for president for a second time, the pantsuit has more and more become the central item in her wardrobe. And I think that that's because it's obviously something that, you know, it's a piece of clothing that she loves and she has really made it her own. She wears it in very bright colours. By going with the pantsuit, a female version of what male politicians are wearing, it makes sense that you are at least hopefully being taken a bit more seriously and there's less attention being drawn to what you wear.
Yes, it's a very much a kind of nod to the boys' club. I was surprised to read that women were not allowed to wear pants or indeed pantsuits on the Senate floor in the US until 1993.
That's right. Isn't that crazy to think about? I mean, you know, we're sort of thinking about something that we take for granted, women wearing pants. But yeah, it wasn't until 1993, a couple of female senators in the United States, Barbara Mikulski and Carol Moseley Braun, wore trousers onto the floor of the Senate in defiance of the rule. And it's sort of since then that women have actually been allowed to wear pants in the US Senate.
We also know that, amazingly, in Kosovo, in the capital, Pristina, there is a store called Hillary that specialises in copies of clothing that Hillary has worn. There's an extensive pantsuit selection. There's some evening outfits that she's worn over the years. Hillary's actually visited this store. She's been there, and it's so successful, they're actually opening another one. I mean, if that is not an indication that someone has a signature style, I don't know what is. Have you ever worn a pantsuit, Nadia?
Well, I'm kind of, I don't wear pants very often, but I am wearing pants today in honour of this conversation and Hillary Clinton. So there you go.
Well, even Lady Gaga has made a nod to the Hillary pantsuit. Last year she was wearing a silver one, which was seen as a bit of a nod to Hillary and throwing her support behind Hillary's campaign. Well, thank you for helping us decode these very important messages that we may well otherwise have missed.
My pleasure.
That's Nadia Buick. She's a fashion curator, writer and researcher, and we'll put a link to her blog, The Fashion Archives, on our website. I'm Cassie McCullough. This is The List. See you next week.